Hey everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Jason Lipschutz, and I am an associate editor and the Pop Shop blog editor of Billboard.com. Based in New York, on the other line, in Los Angeles, is the Taylor Lautner to my Harry Styles. Keith Caulfield, how's it going, Keith?
I'm good, and I have a lot of abs, don't I?
You do have a lot of abs. Is that what Taylor Lautner does? He just walks around saying, I have a lot of abs.
I have a lot of abs, and I'm a little bit wolfy.
He's a little wolfy. So, Keith, full disclosure, let's just start this podcast with full disclosure. Well, first of all, we're going to be talking a lot about Taylor Swift today. It's like an all T-Swift podcast we have planned for the Pop Shop podcast this week. We're going to be talking about, will 1989 sell a million copies in its first week? What we think of the album? What should the second single be? Where Shake It Off is going on the Hot 100, et cetera, et cetera. But before we do that, we gotta be honest with our listeners.
It's all about transparency here at Billboard with Jason and Keith.
It is all about transparency with Jason and Keith. So we're actually recording this on Thursday morning. We usually record on Wednesday afternoons, and we recorded a Pop Shop podcast basically about the same thing, Taylor Swift, with my good friend Sam Lansky, who is the deputy culture editor for Time Magazine. He's a great guy. He knows a ton about T-Swift. He came in, and unfortunately, for some reason or another, the audio just got messed up. And we're going to play clips of Sam talking because it was so great to have him stop by. And, you know, I'm really sorry because it was a great discussion. And we'll have Sam back on the podcast. We'll play a couple clips of what he was talking about. But, for some reason or another, you know, we work in this crazy modern technological world. And sometimes technology
fails us.
This is basically the beginning of Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines.
If you heard the laughing, we actually have an audience. We have an in-studio audience today, too.
We do have an in-studio audience. Yeah, we have our producer, John, in here to make sure that the audio doesn't get screwed up again. I was like, John, you're not going anywhere.
I was joking with Jason earlier. I'm just like, you know, it's kind of like when we introduce Sam's clips, it's kind of like when NPR like throws it to Fallujah. I mean, you know, sometimes the audio quality isn't that good on the phone line.
I know, it
line.
Looks like he's under fire. It's like, but again, I'm sorry to Sam, and like I said, we'll have him back on the podcast. And I'm sorry to Keith because we're recording this before 7 a.m. his time in Los Angeles.
It's fine.
You're a trooper, man.
It's fine. I would rather do this than not.
Well said. So let's get started, man. So Taylor Swift, 1989, it came out on Monday, and it's been T-Swift mania. I said on national television earlier this week that it's Swift-tober, and we are in the middle of it. The big news this week was that we talked on the podcast last week about how it's probably going to sell like 700,000, 800,000 in its first week. I mean, that was an early estimate. Now, it looks like she's going to sell over a million. How did this happen? I mean, the forecast just kept growing and growing.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's actually kind of good that we recorded this on Thursday, in a way, because...
Keep it fresh.
Well, because since we last talked, you know, yesterday morning, Wednesday, the forecast was, it was like going to be a million. And then it was like maybe going to be a little bit higher than that, but I didn't find that until later. And now I know that they're heading for 1.2 million. So I'll back up just a little bit. Like, I guess a couple months ago, the original initial forecast, according to our retail editor, Ed Christman, who is super in touch with the retail industry, he said that the initial forecast was actually 1.1 million, but that was downgraded to 750,000. Like a month or so ago. So initially it was over a million, you know, based on her track record, because her last two albums have both started with more than a million. But then that was downgraded, you know, based upon the information they had at the time. And what we talk about this, when we talk about forecasts, it's all coming from analysts and sales folks and people at record labels and distribution companies that look at how albums traditionally perform in their first week, how the first single's doing, you know, YouTube views of the single, how much radio exposure they have, how many pre-orders they have from places like iTunes and physical retailers, that sort of thing. So they take all that information and try to come up with a forecast. Anyway, it was downgraded to 750, and that was like 2 weeks ago. And then, a week or so ago, it went up to like 800 to 900,000. And then on Monday, it was like, hey, we're going to go 900 plus. And then it became a million. And then it became a million point one. And then now it's like 1.2 million on Thursday morning. And I've asked to see if there's a new update. I haven't got one yet. So right now, as we record this, it's still 1.2 million. But it is kind of nuts how it continues to grow in its forecast and how now it's threatening the first week sales of Red, because her last album, Red, started with 1.21 million. And that was also the last album to sell a million copies in a week.
Wow. So again, so it looks like it looks kind of, I mean, again, we have a couple days to go. It looks like it's more and more of a lock that it's going to pass the million mark. I mean, if the estimate now is around 1.2, it's looked like almost a sure thing that it's going to cross the million.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, I mean, if you want me to dive more into the lurid sticks of sales forecasting, on its first day alone, it sold more than 600,000 copies.
Wow.
Just on Monday.
That's unbelievable. I mean, I don't think people realize that, you know, you think about a million copies over a week, you figure that it's going to be split up seven ways equally. But then, I mean, obviously, if you think about it, the release day is going to have a bigger gain. But wow, 600,000 in its first day.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of that were, you know, pre-orders from iTunes that were fulfilled because it actually set the U.S. iTunes pre-order record. Which I had Apple confirm to me yesterday. So that's another big news bit that I didn't have yesterday, and now I do have. So again, it's good that we did this on Thursday.
Yeah.
No, Apple confirmed to me that Taylor Swift broke their U.S. iTunes pre-order record. The previous record was set by One Direction's Midnight Memories, which sold, which had a pre-order number of 195,000 copies. Now, neither Taylor's record label, Big Machine Records, nor Apple would disclose to me how many pre-orders it had at iTunes, but therefore we know it's more than 195,000. So 600,000 first day, most of those sales are coming from Target and from iTunes. And that kind of makes sense because so many digital buyers buy their music from iTunes. And Target is the only retailer that has an exclusive version of the album with extra content. And so that's really driving a lot of sales.
Gotta get that deluxe version.
There's three bonus tracks as well as three audio memos that she gave to herself that were sort of bits of things like lyrics and melodies that would later become songs. So you can sort of hear her sort of songwriting process through these bonus tracks.
Yeah. So, I mean, why do people care so much, Keith, about the difference between selling 900,000 copies and selling a million copies? Like, is this all about feeling better about the state of the music industry? Is it just kind of like a cool thing to be like, yeah, a million is a cooler number than 900,000?
Basically, yeah.
So it's just kind of like a sexier headline.
Yeah, I mean, To sort of get super sales geeky, I mean, the idea is that a million is such a huge round number. It's much sexier than 999,000 and 999. And it's kind of like, you know, when a movie, you know, hit 100 million at the box office. That's cooler than 98 million. It's just because it's big and there's ones and there's zeros. It's the same. And it's kind of the same reason why, when you think about it, whenever you see advertisements for, you know, things on sale, be it Coca-Cola or a new car or anything in the marketplace, the number will be $7.99, $7.98, $9.99.99. It's never that... this is true. It's never the big round number. You don't see a car advertised for $20,000. You see it offered for $19,999. You know, it's just under that.
Yeah.
Because that the perception is that is a low number. Because you don't have the big round number that it immediately clicks in your brain, oh shoot, that's huge. I can't afford that. When really it's only like a dollar difference or like $100 difference. Of course you can afford it. So the same thing happens when we think about sort of numbers in terms of achievements with album sales, movies at the box office, how many books something, you know, whatever's been sold, it's always sexier to have the bigger number, even if that number is only one unit more than 999,999. That 1 million will always seem more impressive than one unit below it, even though it's only one unit away.
I like this is like the economics lesson of the Pop Shop podcast. I like it.
Well,
it's
take
999,000 Taylor Swift albums and then add it like in terms of sales theory. Yeah, I love it, man.
Thanks. And that's also new to the podcast. I'm not rehashing this from yesterday. It's all new original content that you would have never heard initially.
Well, somehow we should have like. Sort of unlock the key to the lost Pop Shop podcast, like kind of like a Legends of the Hidden Temple thing.
It's kind of like if you buy the version of 1989 at Target, you get a special bonus edition that includes the podcast that you'll never totally hear.
Oh, my goodness. Mm. So speaking of iTunes, so as many have pointed out, 1989 is not available on Spotify. You cannot stream this album. So is that having a huge impact on this massive first week of sales, because or is Taylor Swift just that big? I mean, I go back and forth with this, thinking that maybe more people are compelled to buy the album because you can't stream it, but then it's like, well, how many people are compelled to buy it? Like, is that what do you think?
I think definitely Spotify is playing into the first week, because there are going to be those that have just heard about how like much promotion and hype the album is getting and thinking, well, geez, I need to listen to this album. But the only way that you can listen to it is by buying it. It's not on, I mean, maybe it's on YouTube, but I think that people are trying to make sure that you can't find it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And it's not on Spotify. And I know that people have been taking down links from Tumblr and other sharing sites, trying to ensure that, you know, you buy the album. You're fairly Taylor's fairly compensated for this album. So I do think that the lack of streaming availability is helping sales. Otherwise it would be on Spotify. You know, otherwise it would be on there. And clearly it's not, because her record label thinks that Spotify is would cut into her streams. Now, I don't know if that's the case for every act that is on Big Machine Records or the Big Machine Label Group, which has people like Florida Georgia Line and other folks. I don't know if every single one of their titles has been removed from streaming services for the initial couple weeks that something's on sale. But this isn't the first time that we've seen an album withheld. Sam Smith's album and The Lonely Hour was not on Spotify when it came out initially.
Yeah.
And a lot of people thought of the same idea, like, oh, they're trying to ensure that he has a big first week. And then he eventually later showed up on Spotify, you know, I think like a month or two later. I definitely think Spotify, the lack of it is helping sales. I just don't know how much.
Yeah, I mean, and it's impossible to tell. It would be interesting to kind of find out how many people, you know, raise their hand and say, I bought 1989 this first week because, you know, I wanted to hear the darn thing so much and I couldn't stream it on Spotify. I just had to hear it. You see the same effect with a couple of these, you know, big surprise releases where it's like the Beyonce album comes out in December. And part of the reason I think that it had such a huge sales impact the first couple weeks is because you had to listen to it on iTunes. You had to purchase it to get, especially because it was like a visual album with all
exactly.
the videos. You wanted to see the videos.
Well, that's
and
that,
then,
yeah.
Go ahead. I mean, I was just going to add that, you know, if you look at something in a completely different vein, like Thom Yorke, he just put out his new solo album. And, you know, we don't have reported numbers, but BitTorrent, which was the exclusive home of it, claims it did really well because, you know, I'm a Thom Yorke fan. I'm a Radiohead fan. And it was like, here, you can listen to this album for $5 and you right now, and you're not going to be able to get it anywhere. And I paid the $5. Like, I wanted to hear this album. So, I mean, if you go back to Taylor Swift, maybe people are like, I have to hear this album, and yes, I will pay the money that it takes to do so.
I have a theory on this, and I've talked about this before in the podcast, where those that can actually convince consumers and fans to purchase an entire album have done so because they've been able to effectively communicate the idea of there being an experience to the album. There is more than just a track or tracks. It is more than just a hit single on the radio. It's more than just a cool video. It is about an entire process. It's about an entire experience. And they have been, they meaning Taylor and her team, have been very good at getting across the idea that 1989 is a concept album. It is reflective of the decade that Taylor was born in, which is the 1980s. She was born in December of 1989. It is reflective of her sort of new outlook on life and how that can be, you know, applied to people in general. If you read her introduction to the liner notes, it kind of gives her manifesto to the direction of the album and how, you know, every day is a new day to her, and she's sort of learning something new about herself every day. And, you know, she never thought that she would cut her hair, and she never thought that she would move to New York, and she never thought that she would do all these things that she's done. And yet every day she's always learning something new about herself. And I think that can be applied to a lot of her fans that think of Taylor less of a sort of distant superstar, but someone that's more of their friend, someone that they can relate to and they can sort of learn lessons from.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, so you have that core base that really feels invested. And then you have just the general public that has heard so much about Taylor, and they saw Shake It Off, and they saw the video, and they thought it was fun. And then they also hear these things about, oh, 1989, and ooh, it's a pop album. That's interesting. That's different for Taylor. Ooh, Out of the Woods. I heard that track on Good Morning America. That sounds good. They've heard nothing but good buzz, and they think, well, maybe I'll listen to the whole thing. So you're getting core fans and casual fans to buy into something. And I'll try to trim this down, but the same thing can be said for Beyoncé's album, where Beyoncé created an experience, a visual album, where to fully properly experience it, you had to watch it. You had to watch basically a movie that had a soundtrack that was her album. And the same thing happened with, you know, David Bowie or Daft Punk, where the something happens to convince people that you need to have the whole thing. And that's what's happening with Taylor, and that's why the number is so big.
I totally agree. I mean, we talk about how there are a lack of million-selling albums now in terms of, like, the artists that can do it. Taylor Swift is about to become, if 1989 does cross a million in its first week, she becomes, I guess, the first artist to have three albums sell over a million in the first week ever.
How many
people have done it, or how many albums have done it historically?
There have been a total of 18 instances where there has been a million selling week. So 1989, if it does it, it'll be only the 19th album to sell a million copies in a single week since SoundScan started tracking sales in 1991. So that's a very long time, and only 19, with 1989, only 19 albums will have done that feat. And what's really important to get across, and we talk about this every week in the podcast, is that album sales are in the dumpster. No one buys albums anymore. And somehow, Taylor has been able to, not just because she's a superstar, because lots of people are superstars, but she's a superstar on a different level, a superstar that can actually convince people to want to buy a full album and spend money on it. And she's been able to do that, and that's how she's able to sell more than a million copies now for the third time in a row, following Speak Now, Red, and now 1989. And this year alone, and if you've read any of my stories online about the sales of this album, just in 1 week, she will have the single largest week for an album since her own last album, Red, 2 years ago. She will have the biggest selling album released in 2014 after just 1 week. And let me explain that more clearly. No album released in 2014 in total over weeks and weeks and weeks and months of time has actually sold more than like 700 and something thousand. Coldplay's Ghost Stories is the biggest selling album released in 2014, and it has sold a whopping 741,000 copies. So
Taylor almost passed that in a day.
Yes,
it's 600,000 in a day.
Well, what's
oh my goodness.
What's also crazy is that I heard a number which I can't say it because I wasn't it was given to me sort of off the record and I haven't reported anywhere. But what I will say is I heard that her album did more in its first day just at iTunes than the single largest week for an album this year.
Anywhere. Yeah.
So Coldplay's Ghost Stories actually has the biggest sales week of the year so far with 383,000. She's sold more copies at iTunes, allegedly, just on Monday than Coldplay did in an entire week at all retail. Or crazy. Even if you just want to look at the 600,000 number, she sold nearly twice as much as Coldplay did in the entire week. It's just nuts.
Basically, what we're conveying is that Taylor Swift is a big deal.
Yes.
That's basically what we're
Sorry.
Conveying.
But this
no,
is like
I
so exciting
it.
To talk about like something that is just, this is, you know, like the one time every 2 years we can talk about like, you know, or like a year ago when Beyonce came out. Like this is like the one time where we have something that is just.
It's like a shooting star.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you say it kind of like, you know, sarcastically, perhaps, but it truly is. And I just wonder, does she think about this? Does she care about numbers? Is she concerned about this at all? Or does she sort of grasp like the idea? I mean, she must. I mean, she wrote that Wall Street, was it Wall Street Journal, New York Times?
Yeah.
She wrote that long
Wall Street Journal,
that op-ed piece talking about how her music is art and art should be compensated for. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to pay for music. And, you know, that she's so smart and she's so intelligent. And yeah, it's just amazing.
Where do you think, so how long do you think this album could stay at number one? Because you look at the release schedule, One Direction 4 comes out on November 17th. Do you think that it could just be at number one for the next couple weeks?
Well, is that the next biggest release? I don't actually have the release list in front of me. I'm looking at it quickly, trying to
There's
find
a couple,
out.
I mean, also Foo Fighters comes a week before that.
Well,
so that might be a big one too.
Yeah, I'm looking really quick. So, October 28th, not so much. After that, you get Foo Fighters on November 4th. There's a new Pink Floyd, sort of a quasi-new Pink Floyd album that week. Yeah, I don't think it's going to do that much. Week after that is One Direction. And then after that, you have a new Nickelback album. Yeah, I don't know. So
rock and roll.
So I definitely think Taylor's going to be number one for at least, I'm going to say, 3 weeks. I don't think the Foos are going to get... I just, based on how rock albums have sold this year and based on their track record, I just don't think that they're going to be able to compete even with Taylor's third week. Because historically,
that'd be pretty nuts.
Well,
I mean,
not really. I mean, look, Foo Fighters' last album, Wasting Light, which came out in 2011, so it's kind of a bit ago, it did 235,000 in its first week and it hit number one. So, if think of it that way, if we look at Taylor Swift's last album, Red, in its third week, and that's what the week that it'll be competing with the Foo Fighters,
yep.
Red did 197,000. So yes, Wasting Light had a bigger number than 197,000. However, with the sales the way they are this year, and Foo's last album was in 2011, which is an eternity ago when we talk about anything in terms of sales, I'm not sure that they can actually compete with Taylor's third week. So yeah, kind of sucky for them, but you know, it is what it is. But I think One Direction probably will hit number one. I think that everyone's assuming that they're going to have like, you know, like 400,000, 500,000 type first week.
I guess we'll see, man. So we just did a deep dive
Sorry.
On 1989. No, hey, that's what we're a charts-based podcast, but we're also a pop-based podcast. So let's talk about this album. You know, let's actually in Fallujah.
let's go to Fallujah with Sam Lansky.
Sam Lansky. Again, like I said, Sam is the deputy culture editor for Time magazine and, you know, really like knows his stuff about Taylor Swift. Here's a clip of him again from our, you know, Lost Pop Shop podcast where he stopped in yesterday. Here's him talking about experiencing the wonder of listening to this album. He went to one of the listening sessions actually at her apartment in New York. Apologies for the audio, but check out Sam on the Pop Shop podcast.
I didn't go as a I wasn't like, you know, one of the people that she stalked on Instagram or Twitter, and because I've made very elaborate fan art or something, she invited me to the secret sessions. I went kind of separately because I wanted to see the spectacle of the experience, and it was also I knew I was going to be writing about the album, so it was a great way to hear the album for the first time.
Yeah,
it was unbelievably cool. I mean, like, it was one of the most spectacular things I've ever witnessed, not just because Taylor Swift's apartment is obviously incredible, but also because the sheer intensity of the fan enthusiasm in that room. I mean, like, I felt like we were about to lift off and fly into space.
That's
like,
awesome.
It was, everyone was so euphoric. The fans were so, so, so intense and so giddy just to be there. It was really, really memorable.
So I was actually on vacation when he was at Taylor Swift's apartment, and I was very jealous of him. I gotta say, man.
And I don't know if the audio made it in there, but yesterday when we were talking to Sam, I said, and by the way, Taylor has actually told Sam that he's a great writer. And then he corrected me. He's like, actually, it was an intelligent writer.
yeah.
It was based on
Taylor Swift is a Sam Lansky fan. It's true.
It was actually, and we didn't say why she said this, but he wrote something a number of years ago when he worked for MTV Buzzworthy, the blog. He wrote sort of an op-ed piece about something, and I don't know what exactly it was, but it was sort of like in defense of Taylor Swift, and it was a really well-written piece because Sam is such a great writer. And he then met Taylor like backstage at a meet and greet, and he was introduced to her as, you know, Sam, oh, I work, and she's like, oh, I read your piece. And like, she actually had read it and told him that he was an intelligent writer. And then they've actually had a number of encounters ever since. Like, they've had a number of meet and greets backstage, and, you know, he went to her house and stuff. So that's why it's so important that we have his voice in the show, even if it has really questionable audio quality.
Sam's living that life. But, you know, so let's actually play part of him talking about, he gave some great insight into, he loves 1989, and I will let him explain why. Again, apologies for the audio. We had to salvage this from yesterday, but here is Sam Lansky talking about why he loves Taylor Swift's 1989.
I think it's a statement, and I've read a lot of critics and writers who have really smart things to say about, you know, the sort of absurdity of calling this her first official documented pop album when, you know, by most accounts, Red was also a pop album, and there have been sort of shades of pop in her music for a really long time. I guess, you know, I think what's interesting about this record is that it's a pop album in the way that people who love pop music talk about pop music, as opposed to a pop record in the way that, that like, the general public and mainstream consumers tend to think about pop music.
Yeah.
Like, for people who blog about pop, for people who are really excited about pop, less so for the people who are in their car listening to Rude by Magic, but more so for the people who are like really stoked on the new Robin EP.
Yeah.
This is a pop record for those people. And I'm definitely one of those people.
Yeah.
And so I think for the listeners and fans and critics who get really excited about that kind of pure pop sound in the way that the internet has sort of elevated that style of pop, it's in that vein. And to me, that's really, really exciting. I also think that as a body of work, it's incredibly focused and cohesive in a way that none of her previous albums have been. Red, in particular, I think of as being a really kind of sprawling, messy, great, really brilliant, but, you know, she tried a lot of different things. You know, she worked with everyone from Max Martin to, you know, Jeff Basker, you know, who works with Kanye. Like, there was a real sort of experimentalist and sort of curious bent in that album sonically, and it sort of zigged and zagged. This one feels really clear as a sort of statement sonically, creatively, artistically, and I think that's really impressive because I don't think that's something that we've heard from her. We've heard greatness from her before, creatively, musically, but I don't think we've heard anything this sort of focused.
So Sam's a fan. What do you think of this album, Keith?
You know, and to be fully full disclosure, I haven't listened to the entire album yet. I've listened to
what?
I know. All that talk about all the numbers and how passionate and stuff. I mean, I was reading her liner notes this morning. Trust. I bought the album from iTunes. I was obviously. I mean, I didn't. We weren't serviced with a physical copy. I didn't get like a stream of it, like free or anything, from her record label. I even was talking to the record label yesterday or the day before, and I was like, "Oh, I haven't got it yet. I need to buy it." They're like, "Oh, we can send you a copy." I'm like, "No. I want to contribute. I want to buy the album. I just haven't bought it yet." So I bought it and I read the opening liner notes, which I thought it's so great, and you can sort of see the roadmap of where she's going with the album. But I listened to the first half, and it was funny. we were joking like a week ago about how Ryan Seacrest had listened to the album, and I was saying how he was just like going on and on about how every track is amazing and you just like everything sounds great. And I'm like, oh, come on. Like, I was just immediately dubious. And then I put on the album. I'm like, wow, this I like Welcome to New York. I don't know why people are talking about like it's like, you know, not great. I'm like, oh, I like this track too. Wow, this style, this is a great song. Ooh, I really love, you know, Blank Page. Man, Blank Page, this is really good. And like the clicks of the pen and it's like the turn of, oh wait, and then we get to Out of the Woods. I'm like, geez, I thought Out of the Woods was like the standout track so far. No, wait, never mind. Like every song. Like every song was good. And like, okay, I don't. Like, this is one of those albums where you're like, okay, so far there are no clunkers, and I don't think there are going to be any clunkers on the album.
Yeah. I really like this album, and we talked about it yesterday, but I'll reiterate because it was on the Lost Pop Shop podcast.
But you reiterate it because it's not here today.
I mean, I really like this album. I don't think it's my favorite Taylor Swift album because, you know, I think my favorite thing about Taylor Swift is how much of her personality we get on each of her albums. I mean, my favorite Taylor Swift album, and not just for its sound, but just because of its lyrics in terms of the entire package, is Speak Now, which came out in 2010. I just think the songwriting on that is so crisp and so sharp, and you get, and so personal. First, a big budget mainstream album like that, you know, an album to sell over a million copies again in 2010. It's a really revealing album, and it, you know, you think of a song like Dear John, and but coming, you know, leading right into a snappy pop anthem like Mean. So anyway, going back to 1989, the songs on 1989 are just so breathtakingly impressive in terms of how they're written. I mean, she worked with Max Martin on a bulk of this, as well as Jack Antonoff and Ryan Tedder. This is a pro album. This is an expertly made album. I do feel like you don't get that kind of personality that you get on her past albums. And you know, as Sam pointed out yesterday, Red is a little bit of a mess in terms of its sprawl and the different sounds it covers.
Do you think that was because they were trying to like please country audiences and pop audiences? And
yeah, I think so. But I also think it's just like that's where she was. I think that, and I think that 1989 is where she is now. I think Red is like the sound of her wanting to try different things and saying, you know what, I still want to write these you know, slower. I don't want to say ballads. I don't know what the right word for Begin Again is, but you know, you have a song like acoustically driven like that, right. And then you have 22, which is this bright pop song, and then you have State of Grace, which is kind of like this arena rock song. I think it's her wanting to try different things, and I really respect that album.
There was a great to interrupt, but I'm helping you here. I'm not helping you. You know what I mean? I'm piggybacking on what you're saying. There was something that she said in an interview. It might have been in a Billboard interview. I don't know. Where she, like a couple years ago, when she was trying to like think of who she could work with in terms of songwriters, I think she was telling her label, or Scott Porchetta, which runs her label, like, oh, I'd love to work with Max Martin. And Max Martin has done, you know, a bajillion pop songs for everyone from Britney and Backstreet and NSYNC to, you know, you name it. And they're like, well, why don't you? And she's like, I can. Like, I mean, I don't know who told her that she couldn't, but she was like, I didn't think that I could, and I didn't think that that would be okay. And I mean, it seemed like there was this hesitance to work with Max Martin because of how she had perhaps defined herself and how she felt that she fit within sort of her artistry and the music world. And then so she did on the last album. I want to say both the first two singles, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together and I Knew You Were Trouble, the first two pop singles were both Max Martin productions,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they were.
There were other singles that were sent for like country radio, like Red and 22. I don't know if those were Max Martin songs. But so then she, you know, she clearly blossomed from that. And she refers to, when people ask her, like, what is your favorite song from Red? She says, like, there's no question. It's I Knew You Were Trouble. Like, there's no, like, done. That's it. And if you've already said, like, no, there's no question. That's my favorite song. And, you know, I've always wanted to work with Max Martin. You already kind of know what direction you're going
in. Yeah, exactly.
You know? And so there,
I guess my point is that like I said, these songs are so great. I mean, I listened to a song like Bad Blood, and it's just, it's such a fun song. It's just so expertly made and handled and produced and written and everything. It just kind of has this shine to it. I do think that a song like that could have been sung by someone else, though. And that, I guess that's my point. It's not that this album is more anonymous. I just think that it's a little bit less personal. Taylor Swift personalized.
It's more universal.
Exactly. I mean, you listen to Bad Blood, like I said, it's a great song. Could you picture Avril Lavigne singing that song? I could. And there's nothing wrong with that. I just think that that's one of the things I like most about some of her earlier stuff is that, you know, a song like Dear John, a song like, even a song like Mine, like I just could not picture anyone else singing that as well as her.
You know, I'm okay with the concept of a song being universal and something that is actually could be sung by, you know, other people. But I get the idea of how you want something to be unique and identifiable with that artist. So I can get it from both sides, where it's just like you want something to be universal, but you don't want it to be so anonymous where it just seems like, oh, this is a Rihanna track.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And,
oh, and again, and I'm high. Listen, I say this critically, but I'm high. I'm very high on 1989. I've been listening to it all week. I just think maybe, you know, personally, it's one of my bugaboos, I guess I should call it.
You know, what's interesting, I just had this thought a little while ago, and I think it's sort of important. I've really enjoyed Taylor Swift, in general. Because I feel that she's such a magnetic personality and she's super smart, but I've never really been super invested in her music, to be perfectly honest. I've enjoyed lots of singles. Like, I really loved Love Story. I loved I Knew You Were Trouble. I mean, I like singles here and there, but I never really got into an album. I never really... And I'm a charts person. I'm not like Jason, where I'm an editorial person. So, I mean, because people may misunderstand. They assume, like, oh, you must listen to every album that's on the chart. I'm like, no, I don't. I mean... I do a lot of math and I do a lot of analysis, but I don't necessarily listen to complete albums like Jason does all the time. So what I'm trying to say is I'm more interested now in Taylor, and I'm obviously going to listen to 1989. I bought the darn thing. Because I feel like I've turned a corner for some reason. And the same thing happened with Britney Spears, and they're two very different artists, but I didn't really care about Britney really as a musical artist until the In the Zone album. And yes, I know there was a Madonna track on there. Yes, I know. But I feel like I don't even own the first three albums, but I own every one of the albums after that. And I just really became more interested in her. And I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was just something clicked and I suddenly became really interested in Britney as an album artist. And she's made amazing pop albums since then, except for the last one, which wasn't that great, but still it was okay. But the same thing happened with me with Taylor this time, and I don't know what it is. Sometimes something happens and clicks and you just become a lot more interested in the artist, and she's been able to do that with me, and so that must be working with a lot more people too.
Yeah. Well, Keith, we gotta wrap this up. Two quick questions before we do, in terms of Taylor Swift, and then we'll get to your chart side of the week. Well, Welcome to New York debuts on the Hot 100 this week in the 40s, I believe. How many songs from 1989 could debut on the Hot 100 next week?
Well, yes, you are correct. Welcome to New York actually debuts at number 48 on the Hot 100 this week. It is her 62nd chart entry on the Billboard Hot 100. Yes, 62 entries just since 2006. Well, in terms of how many singles can actually chart on the Hot 100 next week, just from the album sale or from track sales, quite a few. You know, I suspect that, you know, we'll see probably maybe four or five tracks from the album pop onto the chart next week that are not already existing hits. So that's the same thing that happened with her last album. When Red came out, she had five additional tracks debut on the chart that week that were not previously on the chart. So I think at one point, and it was, I think she might have had like seven or eight different songs on the chart at one time. So we could see, you know, eight different songs maybe from Taylor on the chart next week, in addition, you know, with Shake It Off and Welcome to New York and Out of the Woods, and then maybe another four or five album cuts.
Okay. And my last question for you.
What are you eating something right now? Are we having audio issues again?
No. You can hear me, right?
I can hear you ruffling through some paperwork.
Well, yeah, I have papers in front
of me. Oh, okay. All right. I was almost clarifying just in case suddenly everything went south. I'm just telling
I'm a busy
the audience
because
we can't record this again. This is it.
That's true. Yeah. My last question, just very quickly, what should the next single be?
Well, considering I didn't listen to the entire album, I'm not really good judge
what you've
of
heard. Yeah.
I mean,
you have your favorites.
Maybe just pulling out of the woods. I mean, it's resonated so well. Why not? But, you know, that's kind of like a dark horse move. Oh, wait, I compared to Katie. I did. That was bad.
I say either Bad Blood or Style. Mm-hmm. Give me either one of those on the radio. So, Keith, before we go, let's do it, man. Your chart stat of the week.
Okay, so our chart stat of the week is actually not about Taylor Swift. We're having a Taylor Swift breather. It's actually about Enrique Iglesias. Enrique Iglesias this week actually breaks the record for the most weeks at number one in history on Billboard's Hot Latin Songs chart. His song Bailando spends its 26th week at number one this week. And I actually talked to Enrique on the phone this week, actually on Wednesday morning, and talked about the record-breaking achievement with him. And it was pretty cool to talk to him on the phone. He called in from his house in Miami. And he sounded a little bit groggy. I think he had probably, I don't know if he was getting away from a nap, but he sounded a little bit groggy at first, but he picks up halfway through. So it gets really good. So, Jason.
Very cool. Let's listen. Let's listen to Keith talk to Enrique about his chart record on the Pop Shop podcast.
Hi, Keith.
Hello, sir. How are you?
How are you? Good?
I'm great, but you're even better because you know why I'm talking to you right now, I think. Has someone already told you what the big news today is about the charts and Bailando? And
yes, sir. When I woke up this morning, I was very happy.
Well, congratulations. 26 weeks at number one on the Hot Latin Songs chart, the record for the longest running number one in history on the chart. That's crazy. Did you ever think that the song would turn into what it's turned into?
I love the song. The song to me was always a special song, but you never really know. You don't know how successful a song is going to be. I have a tendency to always go with your gut and your instinct, and sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. But this one just felt special.
Clearly. And the song, I mean, it had a really sort of interesting way that it came about. I mean, it was a song that you wrote a number of years ago, and then I think it leaked, and then it became sort of a regional hit in Cuba, and then you were like, whoa, we should record this. Is that kind of how the story, I mean, that's the really abbreviated version of the story, but it kind of took on
that
a life
is.
Of
that's,
its own. Yeah.
That's correct. About a year and a half ago, probably now 2 years, but more likely not a year and a half ago, and we wrote it. When I recorded the song, it made me love what music. There's songs that change your the way you view or the way you feel about music, and I mean that in a positive way. And this was just one of those. When I recorded the song, when I made the video, everything just came together. And I was like, this is what I love to do. That's, you know, this is the reason why when I was 13, 14, 15, I loved this.
Yeah. It must be kind of like sort of affirming in a way that, you know, so far into your career, like you have those moments where you find this song and it's just like one of those aha moments, like, yes, this is why I do this. And this is why this is such a great, you know, career that I have in such a beautiful song. Like, it's great that you can still have those moments and songs that sort of drop out of the sky and turn into sort of phenomenons on their own, like Bailando.
Definitely. I mean, I think every moment you should strive to make it feel like that. Obviously, it's something that you cannot control. But for me, Bailando, just when I look at the songs that I've written throughout the years, songs like from my first single, Si Tu Te Vas, and then songs like Heroes, songs like Escape, like I Like It, that Nunca Te Olvidaré, they're all so different, and to be able to add Bailando to it makes everything I've done eclectic in a cool way.
Yeah, and you know what's really interesting is how this, you know, 15 years or so ago, you had your first sort of top 40 American English language hit with Bailamos, and now 15 years later, you have a hit again with another dance song, Bailando. But this song, which is getting airplay on not just Latin stations, but also, you know, top 40 stations that predominantly play English language songs. But now this song is actually sort of half Spanish. Well, I mean, originally it was all Spanish, and the one that top 40 stations play is sort of half Spanish, half English. But it's interesting how far we've come where, you know, songs that can be sort of bilingual or mostly Spanish can be played across American radio stations, and it's totally normal, and it's totally embraced. And it's interesting how far that, you know, we've come, and you sort of helped start that, you know, back in the day, 15 years ago. Do you ever think about things like that?
Yeah, I think it's so cool how Latin culture has influenced, it's been so influential in the U.S. When it comes to not just to music, but to so many things. It's, for me, this one is special because of that, because I feel that it joins Latin culture and American culture, puts it together, and it shows, you know, what a lot of people like myself, whether you want to call it second generation Hispanics or Hispanics that have been brought up in the U.S., it represents exactly what we're about. And that's what makes this one very, very special. And it's cool that I was able to translate it and still keep the essence and the spirit and be truthful to the song without really jeopardizing what I thought was the quality of what made it a special song.
Absolutely. You know, I mentioned Bailamos, and now we have Bailando. Is there another dance song coming? Because clearly it seems to work. Is there another track that you're thinking of that I'm just kind of joking, but I mean, it seems like the dancing songs work for you. And I just wondered, you know, like, oh, let's do another Bailando type song in the future. But I don't know.
It'd be cool. And the thing is, I wish I could. You can't plan songs like that. That's the unfortunate thing about it, that when it comes down to writing songs, you know, in this case, I was able to collaborate with December Bueno, Gente Zona, with Sean Paul. It's artists that come from different musical backgrounds and put it all together, and it worked. But first and foremost, it all started with a song, being able to write that song. That's something you can't, you know, you really can't, you don't control, and you can't plan it. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But what I don't want to do is, I've never tried to follow a formula. I always just try to go with whatever song I feel is the best song, and I go with my instinct. Whether it's up-tempo, whether it's more Latin, leaning, whether it's more pop leaning, whether it's whatever it is, it truly, or more dance leaning, it doesn't matter. Like, ultimately for me, it's about the song.
It's whatever moves you. It's whatever moves you as an artist. And there's no, people think that there's sometimes a formula to this, but there isn't. It's just whatever makes a great song and whatever resonates with you and what just sounds like it's great. And then if it moves you, then maybe it will move someone else. And clearly that's what happened with this single. Is there anything that I'm missing that you want to tell me that you want to make sure that we know about or we include regarding the song? I don't want to keep you on the phone forever, but I want to make sure that you tell me.
No, it's cool. No, it all really, just the reaction of the fans. Thank you to all my fans just all around the U.S. for making this such an unbelievable hit. I do my best, and I try to, I put so much enthusiasm into songs and songwriting and videos and everything, but ultimately it comes down to the fans and how they react to it. And if it wasn't for them, really the song wouldn't be the hit it's been.
That's pretty cool, man. That's awesome. I mean, Bailando, a massive hit. half a year at number one on our Hot Latin Songs chart. Incredible.
Crazy.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you, Keith, for a very cool and Enrique-assisted Charts Out of the Week. All right, that's going to do it for us here at the Pop Shop Podcast. Thanks again to Sam Lansky for stopping by. And apologies again for some of the audio stuff, but I'm really glad we got to settle down and do this all Taylor Swift Pop Shop Podcast, man. We'll be back next week with the final number of 1989. And again, like as I say, usually check out all of Keith's chart analysis on Billboard.com right now. We have a ton of Taylor Swift stuff on Billboard.com. If you want anything to do with Taylor Swift, just go to Billboard.com right now. Go ahead. Keith, do you have any parting words?
The irony is that I think today's Pop Shop podcast is actually longer than the botched one from Wednesday.
That's fine.
You're getting more Taylor,
Making it up to people.
Yeah, we're giving you more. That's what we do.
Well, we are going to go out on, one of my favorite Taylor Swift songs. Let's do You Belong With Me, man. Let's do it. Thanks again for listening, and take care.